Stars and Galaxies by Robert C. Newman. This is the third of four PowerPoint talks that are a introductory astronomy course for homeschoolers given at Harvey Cedars Bible Conference in June of 2009 and planned to be given again in August of 2009 at the same place. This particular talk, Stars and Galaxies, we're going to look a little bit at what stars are, look at constellations, and then different kinds of stars, and a little bit at the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, how stars end their life, star clusters, galactic clusters, globular clusters, and then galaxies and galaxy types. So, let's jump in. Here we want, in our talk, Stars and Galaxies, to start with stars, looked at from two different perspectives, what they look like from Earth, what we know about them from astronomy and astrophysics. We'll then look at clusters of stars, and finally at the particular type of star clusters we call galaxies. First of all, stars. What are stars? From Earth without telescopes, stars are just points of light in the sky. The ancients called any bright light in the sky a star, distinguishing various types. Fixed stars, what we would typically call stars today, wandering stars, the planets, the sun, the moon, hairy stars, what we call comets, and shooting stars, what we call meteors. With the 20th century, we've come to realize that stars are large balls of gas, held together by their own gravity and illuminated by heat produced within, usually by internal nuclear reactions. Our sun is the nearest star, and stars are distinguished from planets, which might also be largely balls of gas, think of the gas giants, but those planets have no nuclear fusion going on, or brown dwarfs, in which there's a nuclear fusion going on, but it's only deuterium or lithium fusion rather than hydrogen fusion going on. Constellations. Constellation is the term we use for apparent star groups in the sky. Most of these are not actually gravitationally bound groups, but just stars that are in the same direction from where we are here on Earth. There's a standard set of 88 of these constellations used in the West, some 48 of which come down to us from the Greeks and even the Babylonians centuries before the time of Christ. One of these 48 has been split into three pieces, so we could say 50 come down to us from the Greeks, etc. 12 of these constellations mark off what we call the zodiac, which is the band through which the sun, moon, and planets pass in their movements through the sky. Here's a chart showing the zodiac, imagining we're looking down from the north at the sun and the earth going around it, and then we've drawn in the constellations close so you can see them, and you can see which constellations are where and a little bit what they look like, and also something about the idea of the sun being in this constellation, say in Aries in May, as we can see in this particular diagram, as Earth in the May position, you look toward the sun, Aries would be behind it and such. Here are some of the northern constellations with the Big Dipper as a pointer. The end of the Dipper away from the handle, if you follow those two stars upward in several lengths, about five lengths or so, the a straight line from there will reach the North Star Polaris, and that's the standardly known pointer for the Big Dipper. But the Big Dipper can also function as a pointer in various other ways as well. If you take the two stars along the bottom of the cup of the Dipper and run away from the handle, that will come over to the constellation Gemini and pretty close to the brighter star Castor in that constellation. Or if you take the two stars on the side of the dipper towards the handle, the cup of the dipper towards the handle, and go downwards. That line will run across to Regulus, the brightest star in Boötes. And then if you follow the handle of the dipper itself in kind of a curve, that will go over towards, assuming that's Regulus, the star will go, the line will go over to Arcturus, which is in the constellation Boötes. I had the wrong constellation for the Regulus is in Leo. So the phrase arc over to Arcturus is a way of remembering the point, using the handle of the Big Dipper as a pointer. There were no exact boundaries for the constellations in antiquity, but since they are used in modern times to divide up the sky for astronomers and such, the International Astronomical Union established boundaries for the constellations, and here we see a piece of the sky with several constellations, Cassiopeia, Perseus, Andromeda, etc., and lines drawn that rather look like state lines or something to mark the boundaries of these different constellations. Typically, the stars within a constellation are then, first of all, given Greek letters from the brightest downward, and then numbers and such, with the ending of the genitive of the particular word, so Persei or Andromedae, etc., to represent the constellation they're in. What are constellations used for? Well, constellations are used today in astronomy to help observers find their way around in the night sky. They've been used by travelers for direction for thousands of years, and by farmers for information on when to plot, when to plant crops, and that also for a couple of thousand years at least. The constellations have been used, they're still being used by astrologers for fortune telling. Some Christians believe that the constellations portray a gospel in the stars, which goes back to God or the patriarchs. This is an intriguing idea, but so far the evidence for it is not very good. Back to our consideration of the stars then. There are different kinds of stars out there. Even a brief glance at the stars shows us that they differ in brightness. As one looks at the stars more carefully, it becomes apparent they're not all the same color. Look at the constellation of Orion shown in the next panel. You can see here that a bright star to the upper left in the constellation has a rather yellowish or even slightly reddish color to it. That's Betelgeuse, and that is a red giant star. And the bright star to the lower right has kind of a bluish-white color to it, and that's Rigel, and so that shows you some different color. The others that are the bright stars in Orion all have kind of a bluish-white look to them, but you can see looking in the background that the number of the stars definitely are more reddish or yellowish, and one of the objects in the what's supposed to be the sword of Orion, the object sticking down from the three angled stars that represent his belt, has a different color to it, but that's not a star so much as a nebula, though there are lots of stars in it when you look at it with a telescope. Astronomers classify the apparent brightness of stars by magnitude, that is how bright they look here on Earth, by magnitude, what they call apparent magnitude. The lower the number, the brighter the star. And so this comes from antiquity, actually, and the brightest stars were called first magnitude, and the next brightest stars were called second magnitude, and the next brightest third magnitude, etc. Astronomers use a similar system for the actual brightness of the star called absolute magnitude, which is basically the same system, but you imagine all the stars are moved to a position where they're the same distance away, and how bright would they look from that location. Astronomers use a letter system to designate the star color, and these letters are O for very blue stars, B, A, F, G, K, M, moving over to more yellow and finally reddish stars. Mnemonic device to remember these is O, B, A, fine girl, kiss me. Those are the letter systems that are used, and they go back into the 19th century. As I said, the ancients called the brightest stars first magnitude, the next brightest second magnitude, and so on through sixth. Modern astronomy has regularized this system using zero for even brighter of the bright stars and negative numbers for the various brightest objects, and then higher numbers for objects that were invisible without optical help. Sixth magnitude is about the dimmest star that one can see without some kind of binoculars or telescope or something like that. For instance, we'll show some examples of this in the next panel. The Sun has an apparent magnitude of -26.7, very, very bright. Venus of -4.4. Sirius of -1.4. Vega of 0.0. Betelgeuse, 0.4. And the limit with the naked eye is around 5. Absolute magnitude is what the apparent magnitude of a star would be if the star were 10 parsecs away. That's 32.6 light years away. The star color or temperature is roughly like this. The O stars represent approximately a surface temperature of 35,000 degrees Kelvin. B stars about 20,000, A stars about 10,000, F stars about 7,000, G stars about 6,000, K stars about 4,700, and M stars about 3,500. This chart shows that in kind of a graphic form with the colors shown as these bands, starting with a very deep blue on the left and a deep red on the right, and running through lighter blues and then white and then yellow and orange. And the top shows you these O, B, A, F, G, K, M, etc., but shows you something more of the range of temperatures there. And then the numbers on the left-hand side there show you the absolute magnitude of these stars, rather than their apparent magnitude. So that puts the Sun down around a fifth magnitude or something of that sort on the thing. And you can see the various dots there are different stars. So Spica, Rigel, Deneb, etc. are shown there with their names. Here's what we call the HR diagram, or the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. This has on the upper part of the diagram are bright stars, and the lower part of the diagram are dim stars. The left-hand side of the diagram are bluish, very hot stars, and the right-hand side of the diagram are red, very cool stars. The Sun is located right there. So kind of in the middle, up and down, but a little to the right-hand side of left-right. And here we have names of the various stars put on them. Main sequence is the line through the center that kind of curves from the lower right, swings up, and then goes leftward, and then turns up again at the left-hand side. And the red giants over on the upper right, and the white dwarfs down on the lower left. Star sizes. This little diagram shows star sizes. The Sun, a little sort of a dot up there on the left-hand side. And the big thing you see there is the edge of what Betelgeuse would look like. Can't see the whole circle in this particular size chart. Rigel is the big blue one there, and Canopus Aldebaran, the two big yellow ones there. So it gives you some idea of the difference in star sizes. the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram again, the curve through the center is what's called the main sequence. We now know that these are stars that are burning hydrogen in their cores, that they will burn the particular temperature and brightness depending essentially on nothing but the size of the star, the mass of the star, if you like. So a star of a particular mass, if it's burning hydrogen in its core and nothing else has started to happen, if it's above a certain mass, it will be over in the upper left among the blue giants, if you like, and if it's much smaller, it will be down in the red dwarfs. The stars in upper right are red giants. Those are ones that have used up the hydrogen in their cores, and now they're starting to burn helium in their cores, and they're burning hydrogen out in the outer shell out further from the core, and they expand then and become red giants. And the stars at the lower left are white dwarfs. They're stars that have used up all the available nuclear fuel and have collapsed and are now cooling off. The lifespan of a G-type star, the Sun is a G2 star, this spiral in this diagram shows schematically what the life of a G-type star like our Sun would be. It begins in the upper right as a gas cloud collapsing into what we call a protostar. It spends most of its active life on the main sequence, this whole section of yellow in which the star is all about the same size. When it uses up the hydrogen in its core, it expands to form a red giant, burning hydrogen in the outer shell and helium in the core. And when the helium is gone, the star collapses to form a white dwarf. The dwarf gradually cools till it ceases to shine, becoming eventually a black dwarf. Well, larger stars don't end quite that way. They go about through the same thing, up through the red giant and such. But stars that are large enough will explode rather than becoming white dwarfs. That is, the collapse of the star, instead of leading to a stable state, will lead to a state in which there is a explosion inside the star. We call these exploding stars supernovas. The smaller exploding stars collapse to become neutron stars afterwards. The larger exploding stars collapse to become black holes. So here's a supernova. And we can see the gas blasting out, if you like, from the star and running into other gas out in space and producing shock phenomena like we see here. Neutron star has a mass about 1.5 times the Sun for, say, a typical one, and but it's so compressed that it's got all that mass in a sphere that's only about 12 miles in diameter. The theory regarding neutron stars suggests a solid crust about a mile thick, and then a heavy liquid interior made of neutrons largely, with some other particles inside. A black hole is, I suppose, impossible to picture in some sense, but the artist has tried to picture it this way, marking as a black sphere and then cutting into it so you can see inside what's going on, and presumably the yellow in there is light trying to get out and bouncing around or something of that sort. Not sure that's really a good close approximation at all. But a black hole is when matter has concentrated into such a small volume that it is able to bend the space around itself, and not even light can escape from the black hole. That would be the end of stars that are substantially larger than our Sun. Our Sun would collapse into a white dwarf. Stars that are perhaps 2, 3, 4 times more massive than our star will collapse into neutron stars. And then once they get above another threshold, they will collapse into black holes. Star clusters. Star clusters are groups of stars that are really associated, rather than just being in the same direction from us as many of the constellations are. Star clusters are categorized into two kinds, galactic or open clusters, and globular clusters. So we'll look quickly at each of these. Galactic clusters are called galactic because they lie near the plane of our Milky Way galaxy. They're called open because they are not as tightly packed as globular clusters. There are about 500 of these in our part of the galaxy, and they're not real big, typically 20 to 300 stars. We probably can see most of them that can be seen close by, although as we build more powerful telescopes, you can see these further away. This is the Pleiades cluster in Taurus, and this is a rather distinctive star cluster in the winter sky in the northern hemisphere, and is a galactic or open cluster. Globular clusters are so named because they tend to have a rather spherical, that is, a globe shape. They're much larger and more tightly packed than galactic clusters, typically having tens of thousands of stars. Instead of moving in the flat plane of our galaxy, they move in kind of a halo around our galaxy. So above and below the galactic plane and such. Here's M80, the globular cluster in the constellation of Scorpio. Well, that's a very quick tour of star clusters. We move to think about galaxies. Galaxies are what we call the huge star clusters that inhabit our universe. The name comes from a Greek word meaning milk, galaktos. We still use the word galaktos for milk sugar. And that's because the Greeks saw our galaxy as seen from inside as a large path that had a milky color to it. We have generalized the Greek name as a generic term for these things, and then we've used translated it to Milky Way for our particular galaxy. These clusters range in size from perhaps 10 million stars to about a trillion stars. The galaxy in which we live is popularly called the Milky Way because that's what it looked like to the ancients. And here's a picture that a fellow has combined, taken a nice long exposure of the Milky Way, so you can see its stars and gas and dust and such, and then superimposed it behind a nighttime picture of a road. So you see a road on the Earth and a road in the sky, if you like. Here's the Milky Way as we think it looks from outside. It's only been in recent years that we have developed techniques to be able to map the details of the Milky Way from inside very well. And in the course of that, we discovered that our Milky Way was a barred spiral rather than a normal spiral. We'll come back and discuss those in a moment in galaxy types. So here we're looking down on our galaxy. It's kind of a flat thing with a bulge in the middle at the center. And the center is got two arms sticking out of it, and they come out off the end of little short bars, and then different names for the different parts of these spiral arms that come out. But it appears now that they're really just two spiral arms that break up into pieces as they move further away from the center of the galaxy. The little bar down at the bottom shows you what 10,000 light years represents in this size galaxy. So we're looking at something perhaps 100,000 light years across. Galaxies don't just stop suddenly, so they kind of just gradually thin out, if you like. And our galaxy is about 100,000 light years across, and maybe the central bulge is perhaps 20 or 30,000. Galaxies have usually been categorized by shape into three types: elliptical, spiral, and irregular. And they are usually categorized by size into dwarf galaxy, regular galaxy, and giant galaxy. Here's a galaxy classification that's been around for a half century or more now, I guess probably 70 or 80 years by now. In which the ellipticals are put in one line, and then at the end of them, these are split, and the regular normal spirals are put out another line, and then the barred spirals out another line. So you get kind of a tuning fork diagram of the spirals. We don't know whether this actually tells you anything about how they're related or not. But over on the left end, the EO elliptical is an elliptical that is virtually spherical shaped. And then that gets more and more flattened as you move down the handle of the tuning fork until you get to the forking spot. And there you have kind of a nucleus in the middle of a rather flattened thing, but not yet any obviously spiral arms. And then as you go out the two pieces of the tuning fork, you get less and less nucleus and more arm as you go out either one of them, and the normal spirals just come off the nucleus without any bar to them, and the barred spirals have a bigger and bigger bar, if you like. So galaxy classes on this kind of a category, our Milky Way would be something like an SBA. So our galaxy is now known to be a barred spiral, something like a SBA in that classification. Our galaxy contains perhaps 200 to 400 billion stars, so it's a rather large spiral. Its mass has recently been estimated to be around 3 trillion solar masses, but most of this would be dark matter. I'll say more about that in our next lecture. Its size is about 100,000 light years across and about 10,000 light years thick. I think I said 30,000, or about 10,000 light years thick. Well, that's the end of our talk here, and we will continue on, Lord willing, with a fourth talk on the cosmos, as the fourth talk that would end up the introductory astronomy lectures that cover kind of just the astronomy, if you like. We have a fifth lecture, which has been in our collection for some time, on the star of Bethlehem, what is it? Which we give at the end, which pulls together some of these things and helps you to see that we live in a world where God has intervened as well.